I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. A federal judge in Tampa, Florida, has scheduled a hearing for this afternoon to decide whether doctors should reinsert Terri Schiavo's feeding tube, the feeding tube that has kept her alive in a persistent vegetative state for the last 15 years. Doctor removed the tube 3 days ago per a state court order, but over the weekend, Congress passed a law sending the case to a federal court, the first time a federal court has intervened in a euthanasia case. Congressman James Sensenbrenner is a Republican from Wisconsin and chair of the House Judiciary Committee. He says it's up to Congress to support Terri Schiavo.
When a person's intentions regarding whether to receive life-saving treatment are unclear, the responsibility of a compassionate nation is to affirm that person's right to life.
Joining us from Orlando, Florida now is Pat Duggins. He's news director at public radio station WFME. Pat, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And in Washington, we welcome back the Miami Herald's Leslie Clark. Nice to speak to you again, Leslie.
Good afternoon. Nice to be here.
And, Pat, let's start with you in Florida. Congress passed the bill just after midnight. President Bush signed it an hour or so later. We understand by 2:30 a.m., Terri Schiavo's parents' lawyer was standing on the steps of the federal courthouse in Tampa. He was there to file their lawsuit. On what grounds?
Basically, that Terri's religious beliefs are being infringed upon, that the removal of her feeding tube violated her rights, and that she has not been provided a lawyer yet. And there's a lot of emotion, as you might imagine, Robin, on both sides of the issue. Mr. and Mrs. Schindler are desperately trying to save their daughter's life. On the other side, you've got Michael Schiavo, who says that 19 Florida judges have heard arguments regarding the removal of Terri Schiavo's feeding tube, and all of them have sided with Michael Schiavo. So we're just into another chapter.
And remind us, she doesn't have a lawyer, but does she have court-appointed guardians?
We have to look into that. I'm not positive at this point. Okay. There was a number of lawsuits, including one just last week, quite frankly, from Circuit Judge George Greer that would allow the removal of the feeding tube. And at this point, Michael Schiavo, I'm double-checking my information here, Michael Schiavo is the guardian for Terri Schiavo because they're still married at this point. Okay. He is living with a girlfriend and their children, but according to the courts, he's still married to her.
Well, then what happened after that lawsuit was filed earlier this morning?
Well, after that, basically you're going to have Judge James Whittemore, as you mentioned this afternoon, taking a look at this inch-thick brief that was provided early this morning by the Schindlers, that's Terri Schiavo's parents, and from that, the judge is going to be talking to a number of expert, you know, friends of the court experts, that sort of thing, taking a look at the arguments from both sides, reading the brief, and then after that, deciding whether or not there should be yet another trial or another hearing to see what should be done about Terri.
And by the way, that Judge Whittemore was picked by a random computer system, correct?
And all I know is that he was actually appointed to his position by President Clinton. So, you know, if anyone critical of what the Congress did today was looking for someone to be objective, it seems as though that at least we're moving in that general direction.
Well, let's turn to Leslie Clark. She's in Washington. You were on Capitol Hill this weekend. These extraordinary events unfolded. First of all, how many attended the Senate convention that convened to write this law, and how many attended the House? Were people physically there?
Yeah, nose counting was very easy when it came to the Senate. There were three senators when they passed the bill yesterday afternoon. The Senate had passed a similar measure on a voice vote last week. And then the House members, because there were objections raised by Democrats yesterday afternoon, the House Republican leadership scrambled all day to get enough members back, which is 218, for a vote incredibly early this morning.
And what exactly does the bill say?
The bill says that it gives the Schindler family, Terri Schiavo's parents, standing to ask a federal judge to intervene in the case. And then it allows a federal judge who determines whether or not they will review the case to conduct what's called a de novo hearing, which is essentially a new hearing all over again, bring in new witnesses, look at the testimony, and not at all, does not require him to be at all follow what Florida state law has or to look at what the other judges have determined. So he's not really bound by anything that's happened in the past.
Well, Pat, back in Florida, people we know have been holding vigils near the hospice outside the home of Michael Schiavo, Terri's husband. What's the sense of the feeling there?
Well, you've got It's very polarizing and very emotional, as you might imagine. On the one hand, you've got people who are supporting Michael Schiavo, who are extremely angry about what Congress did today. As I mentioned earlier, 19 judges over a period of better than 7 years have almost unanimously, frankly, sided with Michael Schiavo, that Terry did, in fact, say that she wished to die and that the feeding tube should be removed. On the other hand, you've got this extraordinary move by the Congress and by the President to allow Judge Whittemore to again take a look at this issue. So all you have to do is go on the Internet and do a Google search on Terry Schiavo, and it's just amazing just how polarized everyone seems to be. You've got folks who believe that Terry does have the right to live. You've got people like Michael Schiavo who say that people do have the right to determine their own future. So it's a personal matter that's become public and just very, very emotional.
And Leslie, in just the very few seconds we have, we just want to ask you about the politics of this. There was a report that there was a memo circulated over the weekend seeming to give the Republicans talking points on this matter because it would energize their base. Has anyone claimed that report?
Yeah, no, they've done a lot to distance themselves from it. Both Tom DeLay and Bill Frist have said, I never saw it, nobody saw it, and we wouldn't have done anything like that. But to a person, everybody acknowledged that it's sort of hard to divorce the politics from a situation when you've got 535 politicians involved in it.
Yeah. Leslie Clark, a reporter for the Miami Herald, speaking from Washington. Pat Duggins, news director at WMFE. He's in Orlando, Florida. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, the vote in the House of Representatives was 203-258 in favor of the bill that could possibly lead to Terry Schiavo's feeding tube being reinserted. Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch is one of 47 Democrats in the House who voted for the bill. We reached him earlier today. He was on his cell phone at Reagan National Airport in Washington, and I asked him how he reached his decision.
A lot of us just tried to get as much information as we could regarding the medical opinions, but they were varied, and I know that both sides tried to paint this thing as being something that was clear-cut, but if you were open to all the evidence, there was definitely testimony and evidence that went both ways. There was a case where I understand perfectly the positions of my colleagues who voted the other way, both Republican and Democrat who voted the other way. But it was a vote of conscience, I think. And whereas, you know, the vote to allow this to be heard in federal court may in fact generate the same response, may generate the same result, but it will be, it will have been the full recourse for the Chandler family and the Schiavo family. And I think the fact that, you know, we have a situation here where there's been starvation basically instituted played to the compassion of some members.
But do you understand, Representative Lynch, that in fact the preponderance of doctors and those who care for the terminally ill say that this is, in fact, one of the most compassionate and gentle ways to die?
Yeah, I understand some have that opinion. Look, I'm Irish. We've never looked kindly on starvation. I don't buy that. I don't buy mm-hmm. that someone should watch their daughter starve to death, and that we should be accepting of that. The mother and father who brought that woman into this world did not want to see her starve to death, and I felt that just as a person, that I should try to stand with them.
You're saying that you got involved in what's an extraordinary act, that Congress would step into this case and,
right,
in some say, trump states' rights and get involved in a personal family issue. You did it largely to give the parents one more shot, even if the federal judge rules exactly as all the lower courts have.
Absolutely.
Congressman Lynch, thanks very much for speaking to us.
Thank you.
That was Congressman Stephen Lynch of Massachusetts. We spoke to him earlier today on what was for him a very emotional, ethical decision. Well, we turn now to Dr. Arthur Kaplan of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. And Dr. Kaplan, can we just start at the beginning? Can you sum up where are we now in terms of this case?
Well, right now we're in a weird place with the Schiavo case. We've got Congress saying, take this matter up and let it be considered by a federal judge. At the same time, no one is disputing any of the facts about the case. We have had probably 26 trials in Florida courts that have not changed or challenged the findings of the court. So I'm not sure what the federal judge is going to do. Unless he can find something or she can find something wrong with the procedures here, it would be hard for anybody to overrule the facts of this case on an appeal.
And remind us what those facts are by first of all explaining the two sides in the case. We've got Michael Schiavo, the husband, on one side, and many doctors siding with him, the parents and siblings of Terry Schiavo on the other. Can you just sum up their sides?
So at this point, we've got a husband who says, my wife would not want to live this way, and it's not an issue of quality of life. It's not an issue of disability rights. It's she made her wishes known to me. I've confirmed them with some other family members who were present when she said that. That's all been introduced into the record. And so I'm trying to do what she wants done.
And you write that he's held to that over years, despite a campaign against him.
In fact, he has held to that despite the fact that some people have said he's not trustworthy because he's living with another woman, he's had children with another woman. There have even been allegations that he caused harm to her, and he's trying to hide that. None of this is held up in court. It is true that he lives with another woman, but of course he can't divorce Terry. He would lose his ability to act as her guardian at that point, so he's in a catch-22. And it's pretty clear that Terry got into the state due to a potassium deficiency, which is linked in 21-year-old women to an eating disorder. No one would have harmed her and caused a heart attack. So as ironic can be, we're fighting about a feeding tube for a woman who got into this situation because she had an eating disorder.
On
the family, however, still says, we know better than her husband what she would want. We don't think he lived with her that long. We don't think he really understood her values and views. And so the courts have been asked to adjudicate what is basically a domestic dispute. And Congress is also saying, if there's a chance at life, we have to protect life. Morally and legally, they're on shaky ground here. We have feeding tubes, respirators, dialysis, antibiotics taken away from people all the time in American hospitals, hospices, and nursing homes. If you come in as a Jehovah's Witness, we don't force blood upon you. If you're a competent adult, if you're a Christian Scientist, we don't force anything upon you. There are lots of people who at various points in their disease or illness say, stop treating me or take my feeding tube away.
But you mentioned the Christian Scientists. I just want to interject that the parents are saying that Terry is a Catholic and she has the right to honor, you know, papal teachings that feeding tubes should not be removed from people in permanent vegetative states.
Well, it's interesting. The teaching that the parents talk about was issued about 9 months ago. Prior to that time, going all the way back to Karen Ann Quinlan, the Vatican had taught that you can remove a feeding tube. So if you want to go with the Catholic Church position at the time she became incompetent, it wouldn't be the one that came out of the Vatican 9 months ago. It would be the one that prevailed, if you will, 17 years ago. I think there are many Catholics, including the American bishops, including Australian and Canadian bishops, who also think that papal teaching is flawed. And there are certainly many Catholic hospitals that do disconnect feeding tubes. So it is a teaching, but it's not one that either is clearly going to bind her or one that she necessarily would have followed.
We're talking to Dr. Arthur Kaplan. He's director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. We're talking about the Terry Schiavo case, and a federal judge will be holding a hearing on the case at 3 p.m. East Coast time today. We'll continue our discussion with Dr. Kaplan when we come back. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. As we've been reporting, a federal judge in Florida will consider the case of Terry Schiavo this afternoon after Congress and the president approved legislation putting the case in the hands of the federal court. We've been talking with Dr. Arthur Kaplan of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Kaplan, you've said that you think the final decision should be up to Terry Schiavo's husband, Michael. Why?
I think that Michael Schiavo has the right to make this decision because despite all the attacks, all the slurs, all the attempts to disqualify him, courts have found him still credible as the person who knows best what she would want. And I think unless somebody can come up with some reason to push him out of this case, and they haven't, over 7 years of trials, remember this thing has gone up 11 times to Florida appellate courts, 4 times to the Florida Supreme Court, 4 times to the U.S. Supreme Court, that's a lot of review and a lot of due process. If he still stands after all of that, I don't think there's any need for federal courts or anyone else to try and insert themselves in here. So I think, like it or not, he's got the say. And that is the place you turn when you're in doubt. You try to go to next of kin. You try to go to spouses before you go to parents.
And what about the lawmaker's role? I mean, we spoke to one who said that this is a very emotional, gut-wrenching case, and he just wanted to buy a little more time, and that the law that has been passed can't be used as legal precedent. It can only apply to Terry Schiavo. Do you agree?
Well, a couple of things about that. I am very, very skeptical that this law that Congress put in to have the federal courts review it is going to hold up. The state of Florida did this under Jeb Bush in the legislature, and the U.S. Supreme Court said you can't just pass a law saying Terry Schiavo's case should be reviewed, Terry Schiavo's cannot have her feeding tube taken away. Laws, for one, generally don't fly very well in our constitutional system, so I doubt that that's going to hold up. I also have my doubts about people who say we need more time to look and see. If you had 26 trials, as I said, continuous appeals up and down with probably more than 30 judges who've looked at this thing, it becomes almost impossible to understand what more review you would need. People may not like the decision that Michael Schiavo says his wife would have wanted to have made, but I don't think there's going to be any more due process that will produce anything else to change what has been said about this.
Well, Arthur Kaplan, you turn over these kinds of ethical questions all the time. Do you ever hesitate? I mean, there are people who, you know, sitting on the sidelines, and much of America is sitting on the sidelines, who say, yeah, but what if? What if there's a young woman in there who is trying to communicate as her parents believe? What if?
Well, I'd say this. People have looked at the film that's been shown of Terry. It's already a few years old, and they see her apparently interacting, tracking a balloon around the room, sort of looking at her parents. But what I find myself thinking is the thing you have to really look at for her medical prognosis is her CAT scan. And that was done in 2002. Three independent neurologists, one from the University of Minnesota, one from the Cleveland Clinic, one from the University of Florida, came in and said her brain has atrophied. Her cerebral cortex is gone. This is not a person who's going to get better, recover. No therapy will help her anymore. So I don't worry too much about the what-ifs here. What I worry about is in all the ideology and all the rhetoric, people have not bothered to look at the trial transcripts, have not bothered to look at what the medical experts saw.
Dr. Arthur Kaplan is the director of the Center for Bioethics at the University of Pennsylvania. He spoke to us from his office in Philadelphia about the Terry Schiavo case. Dr. Kaplan, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Well, the U.S. Supreme Court has declined several times to get involved in the case of Terry Schiavo, but the justices did issue several rulings today. And with a quick court chat, we turn to Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston. Lyle, first of all, catch us up on the court's involvement in the Schiavo case. They did decline last Thursday to get involved, correct?
Yes, they declined twice last week to get involved, and once earlier when Governor Jeb Bush tried to bring the case up, they denied review at that time. So the case has been here in one form or another three times in recent months.
And your sense, this was all before Congress passed this extraordinary law moving the case to a federal court. Any chance this case could come back to the Supreme Court?
Well, I think it's almost a certainty, Robin, that it will be back because the family has started the new process in federal court in Tampa this morning, and that case will go from there on to the 11th Circuit in Atlanta and presumably on to the Supreme Court, and it may all unfold within the week.
Well, today, 80-year-old Chief Justice Rehnquist returned to the bench for the first time since being diagnosed with thyroid cancer. How did he seem to you?
Well, he was fairly strong physically. His voice is weak. His voice, in fact, is barely recognizable. But he did conduct the court's business, as he usually does. And during the two hearings that they held this morning, he took an active part. Some people who were there thought it was a little less active than he normally was, but it seemed fairly close to normal.
And one of the orders handed down by the Supreme Court today, they declined to take up the appeal of 9/11 terrorism suspect Zakarias Moussaoui. He had appealed to a lower court that he should be able to get information from other suspects being held by the U.S. What does the Supreme Court's decision not to hear his appeal mean?
It means that the trial judge in Alexandria, Virginia, will now set a trial date, and that will go forward. It's probably going to take several months to actually get to the opening of the trial because the trial judge, has to work out a procedure by which Moussaoui's defense lawyers can make some use of what these three al-Qaeda operatives told U.S. interrogators.
But he can't actually meet with them.
He cannot meet with them. He can submit written questions with no assurance that they would be answered.
And briefly, the court also heard arguments about whether police failed to protect the children of a Colorado woman. She had a restraining order against her husband. He ended up kidnapping and killing the children. What precedent could be set here based on how this court rules?
Well, the court is being asked to examine whether or not the government, particularly in this case local government, can be held responsible when somebody for whom the government is responsible is harmed by the government's negligence. The court ruled several years ago that the government cannot be held legally to blame when a child is injured by a foster parent because the government doesn't have any obligation to protect an individual against a private person. That may be the precedent that could turn out to be controlling in this case, and Mrs. Gonzalez might not win.
Supreme Court reporter Lyle Denniston speaking to us from Washington. Lyle, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And back to the case of Terry Schiavo. Because of a law passed this weekend by Congress, a federal judge is expected to hold a hearing on that case at 3 p.m. East Coast time today. We will be following the story closely for you. Stay with us as more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now with the story of a businessman on trial facing allegations of massive fraud. No, it's not WorldCom's Bernard Ebbers or Enron's Ken Lay. This story dates from the Roaring Twenties, and the businessman in question is a charismatic Italian immigrant named Charles Ponzi. He launched the investment scam that bears his name back in 1919 in Boston. Michael Zuckoff is the author of the new book, Ponzi's Scheme, The True Story of a Financial Legend, and he spoke with Here and Now's Bob Oakes.
Before we talk about the man, Mr. Ponzi, and the famous scheme, tell us a little bit about the climate of the times, the get-rich-quick ethos of the 1920s.
Sure. You know, we're talking about a period just after World War I, when people were expecting a booming economy. They wanted a piece of the action. They thought that this was the time the American dream was going to come true for them. They saw the stock market was starting to rise, and immigrants who had flooded to the country maybe were willing to tolerate tougher times during the war, but now the war was over, and it was time to get rich. And people wanted to get rich one way or another, and it was a time when both in the movies, whether it was a Valentino movie or on stage, rich men's fantasies were every man's fantasy.
It was the Roaring Twenties.
It truly was.
Now tell us about Charles Ponzi. Who was he? Give us a little bit about his background. And how did he fit the bill for the times? Well, he came from a pretty modest family, small town in Italy. Was he an unlikely character for this or not?
He was an unlikely character in some ways. He had come. He was one of the huge influx of Italian immigrants to this country. And he had come here in 1903 with little money, but a tremendous amount of charisma, tremendous amount of self-confidence, and he was just the right guy at the right time. But first he had arrived here in 1903, and he spent the next 15 years basically bouncing around up and down the East Coast, having adventures and misadventures before he really struck on his scheme.
He actually had legal trouble in Montreal.
He did indeed. He was arrested there for passing a bad check when he was working at a bank, and he spent some time in prison. And then when he came back to the United States, he brought some other Italian immigrants with him and then was again sent to prison in Atlanta this time. But he also had heroic adventures as well. He, for instance, he literally gave the skin off his back to save a young woman who was burned in a mining accident. And so, you know, Ponzi has become synonymous with swindle and, you know, sort of a one-dimensional character as a bad guy. But what I found was he had more humanity than people might have expected.
Tell us about the scheme itself.
Sure. In 1919, Ponzi was looking for a way to get rich, and he was writing to correspondents over in Europe, and one sent him a letter back with a little certificate in it, and as he opened the letter, it fluttered out onto his desk, and that was truly a eureka moment for Ponzi. What he had in his hand was something called an international reply coupon. It's a very unusual, very mundane, though, kind of security, almost. It's a little kind of piece of currency that allows you to buy a stamp, a 5-cent stamp, in any post office in the world. Ponzi realized that he could take that and buy one amount of stamps in Bulgaria or Italy or one of these countries that had seen their currencies devalued after World War I, and by many more of them in the United States. It was an arbitrage. It was a currency exchange that technically was both legal and possible, but it was impractical. But that was the basis of his scheme, and he thought if he could get people to give him money, he could then buy thousands upon thousands of these coupons, convert them into cash, and retire rich.
And give him money, many, many people did.
They did. They came flocking to him. As I said, he was extremely charismatic. He was just a wonderfully personable man. He was only about 5'2", but he projected about 6'4". He just was the kind of guy who would be like a drum major leading a parade. And people kept coming, and each time they came because they were lured by his promise of profits. He promised them 50% interest in 45 days at a time when banks were paying, you know, a few percent a year. They came, he promised to give it back, and he did. And when he did, they just reinvested, and he knew they would. And it was truly a snowball going downhill.
Now when you say when people invested and he paid them back, that was the first few investors, right?
Yes, the first 18 investors who had came to him by January of 1920 were offered their money back by Ponzi with their interest. Most just said, wait a second, I want another spin of the wheel. I don't want my money back. I want to try more.
And eventually, people came out of the woodwork, and we're not talking about moneyed people here. We're talking about very blue-collar people who were giving him a few dollars in hopes of making just a few dollars more.
The bulk of his investors were blue-collar workers, office workers, charwomen, street sweepers. But then, after they were starting to make money or imagine they were making money, others did follow. Three-quarters of the Boston police force invested with Ponzi. You had Brahmin bankers who were taking their money out of their own banks. One came with $10,000 to give to Ponzi. So people believed.
Before it fell apart, Ponzi became you write that Ponzi became a major celebrity in Boston.
Oh, he was the most popular man in Boston. He would walk down the street and literally people would fall into line behind him. People wanted him to buy the Red Sox because they were so mad that the Red Sox had traded Babe Ruth just the previous year. He was the most popular.
Charles Ponzi the savior.
Yeah.
Did Ponzi actually buy any of these international securities and invest these people's money, or did he just put it in his mattress, so to speak?
No, he never really invested in those. It was no way. He found no way to practically carry out his original plan. So what he did was he used the old fraud of robbing Peter to pay Paul, paying later investors with the money from new investors.
Hence our modern term, Ponzi scheme.
Exactly.
I can't help think that part of Ponzi's defense, and I'm not speaking about legal defense now, is something that's regularly employed by the rich and powerful who get into trouble today. Hire a press agent, a press agent then, a PR firm now, and let that press agent pound away at the critics and the accusers.
Yeah, and he did all of that. He invented that approach. And he also invented the defense that said, a promise of profits is not larceny. It's just a promise. And as circumstances change, your promises change too. With something we've heard right up to the Bernie Ebers trial or the WorldCom or Enron, it's a familiar defense now, but Ponzi invented it.
Michael Zuckoff is the author of the new book, Ponzi's Scheme, The True Story of a Financial Legend. He spoke with Here Now's Bob Oakes. And as always, we welcome your thoughts on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message, 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Well, still to come, the acclaimed author of the book Housekeeping took over two decades to write her new novel, Gilead, but perhaps she was onto something. It just won the National Book Critics Award for Best Fiction of 2004. We'll speak to Marilyn Robinson. You're listening to Here and Now. Is the big auto company GM in big trouble? The world's largest automaker is reportedly making deep cuts in its white-collar workforce and is expected to press its largest union, the United Auto Workers, for concessions to help lower costs. The Wall Street Journal is reporting today that up to 28% of white-collar jobs will be eliminated in some units, this following GM's announcement last week that its 2005 earnings will be much lower than expected, news that sent GM's stock to its lowest level in a decade. For more on GM's mounting list of troubles and how they affect us, we're joined by Here & Now's business reporter Mark Mills. Mark, what's gone wrong at General Motors?
Well, Robin, a lot of problems have hit at the same time. Sales of their most profitable vehicles, the SUVs and trucks, are slowing down in part because high oil prices are discouraging people from buying some of those big behemoths. Rising health care costs are adding to overhead. There's stiff competition from Asian automakers. Steel prices have gone up as the Chinese economy has hit overdrive. Rising interest rates are cutting into profits at the company's financial arm, GMAC, which actually makes more money than they make in the manufacturing side. And there's just too much capacity in the auto industry worldwide, and all these companies can't run all these plants economically. So lots of things going on all at once.
Well, you know, I just want to ask you, these are things that affect every automaker. Is there something that GM did in particular that was wrong, didn't see a trend or something?
Well, of course, a lot of the foreign automakers don't face some of the same overhead costs that we're facing in the U.S. Ford has some of the same problems GM has. Chrysler has some of these problems as well, although they are owned by Daimler of Germany, so their situation's a little different. But GM does have some bigger, what they call legacy costs, and these are the costs of retirees, benefits, health care, and pensions, and so on.
Sometimes it doesn't pay to be the biggest. Well, what is General Motors doing about it?
Well, they're trying to cut costs, and they're trying to figure out how to come out with some new models to boost sales. On the cost-cutting side, they are trying to reduce the white-collar workforce, as you mentioned. There have been buyout offers, for example, going to thousands of white-collar workers, and this week many people are expected to accept those offers. But they're doing things like merit pay increases for non-union workers have been eliminated for this year. They're cutting back on the company match on an employee stock purchase plan. They're putting the squeeze on their suppliers to cut their prices. And perhaps the most controversial step will be plans to approach the United Auto Workers for contract concessions. On health care, for example, Robin, union workers pay no share of the premium at General Motors, which is pretty unusual in the workplace these days.
Well, there's going to be a fight there. You can probably project that. But you mentioned they are trying to come out with new models. What about coming out with new products that would help them grow out of their problem?
Well, they're going to try and do that. It's a little like the Hollywood industry, though. You hope you come out with a hit, but you might not. In the first 2 months of this year so far, GM sales have sunk to 25% of the U.S. market share. That's down 1.5% from last year. Critics say GM has let its truck product line, which is very profitable, grow kind of stale in recent years, and its cars, for the most part, have not been big hits. Some analysts say that the consumer's appetite for new cars may have been satisfied in the last few years when low interest rates fueled a car-buying binge in the U.S. GM does say one area where it will not cut back is in developing and rolling out new models, and they said they will actually speed up the release of some new models to try to generate some excitement and some more revenue.
And by the way, you mentioned that other car companies have some of these issues, but that GM has this huge labor force and these legacy issues. We understand that for every vehicle it sells, GM spends more than $900 in health care costs for retirees.
Yes, they do pay health care for retirees. They've had a lot of people leave the company in recent years, and they will give them health care in retirement. So you have almost $1,000 built in overhead for workers who are no longer employed by the company. The health care bill for current workers and retirees works out to more than $2,000 per vehicle, Robin. So that's a tremendous nut to have to deal with in the competitive situation globally. A lot of foreign companies do not have those costs, so it's making it difficult for the U.S. firms to compete.
Right. In just a few seconds we have, and while we have you, because there's more news on the business front, the Federal Reserve is going to meet tomorrow. Inflation and housing will be the focus of several economic reports this week. Just give us a quick headline.
All right. We expect the Federal Reserve to raise rates by another quarter point, the seventh consecutive time they've done it. Hopefully inflation numbers will be tame because we don't want to get everybody riled up with inflation. And the housing numbers will be important, Robin. We have higher rising rates, and we'll see if that's starting to slow down the housing demand.
Here & Now's business reporter Mark Mills. Mark, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Author Marilyn Robinson won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction for her novel Gilead last Friday. The book came out last fall, 23 years after Robinson's classic jewel, Housekeeping. Marilyn's new novel tells the story of 74-year-old preacher John Ames, who was living a life of holy poverty in Gilead, Iowa in 1956, unexpectedly blessed with a 6-year-old son from his marriage to a much younger woman. The book takes the form of letters to the Reverend's young son, telling him of the 100 years of family preaching, the fierce, one-eyed great-grandfather who moved from Maine to the Midwest and conspired with, perhaps murdered with, the abolitionist John Brown, the pacifist grandfather who sat with Quakers, and John Ames himself, eyeing the world with wonder to the last minute. We spoke with Marilyn Robinson when the book first came out, and I asked her, where did the character of John Ames come from?
I try to explain this to people, and it sounds like a kind of mysticism or something, but when I write novels, I'm dependent on having the sense of the voice that would be the teller of the story. And these voices simply sort of, something suggests them to me, or they put themselves together out of odd bits. I don't know how it happens, but in any case, at a certain point, I had the conception of this man. He grew out of a minor character in another piece of fiction I was working on that I didn't like. But it simply happened at a certain point that I knew this voice and knew a great deal about him.
Well, as we said, your character is John Ames. He's telling his young son the story of the boy's great-grandfather, or John Ames' grandfather, a man who fought violently against slavery. And this fierce grandfather has a son, John Ames' father, who also becomes a pastor, but who's an ardent pacifist. What does your book say about faith-based activism?
I suppose that I have not put my characters in the position of solving a moral dilemma that I myself cannot solve. Mm. I think it's a very real question. I think if ever a war was justified, perhaps the Civil War was justified from the point of view of the North. And I think it's important to remember that what set it off was, in the first place, the lawful election of Abraham Lincoln, and in the second place, the firing on Fort Sumter, which was a Southern choice. So there's no question that the slave system was penetrating the whole country, and that if anything meaningful was to be salvaged out of American experience to that point, slavery had to be ended. Mm. But on the other hand, it was a terrible war and a horrible loss to the country and a shame and a disaster. Both of these things are true at the same time.
Right. And your character, again, John Ames, at 74, is contemplating all of this as he looks towards the end of his life and tries to leave something for his son to read, and as he also contemplates the modern world. I mean, I'm thinking of images in 1956, light reflecting off a sprinkler that his son is jumping through. A lot of readers of Gilead are going to, of a certain age, are going to be reminded of their own grandparents in the 50s and maybe what their internal lives were like. And I found myself reading and thinking, gee, I forgot how far back their lives extended.
Yes, my own grandfather used to talk about his boyhood on the Great Plains. It was amazing. I mean, it just seemed as if it had been hundreds of years before.
We're speaking to author Marilyn Robinson. And in your book, the character John Ames writes letters to his son, and they're steeped in the small observations about life. Children, for instance, who baptize part of a litter of cats, and then they're worried, you know, which ones they've missed and have consigned to a life of paganism. Here's a line that you write. Grasshoppers fly up from a dusty Kansas road, making that little snap they make like a striking of a match. How do you write? Do you gather these observations yourself and then find a place in a novel where they fit?
Well, one of the questions that I'm very much in the habit of asking myself is, what is it like? You know what I mean? If I notice that something's striking to me, I try to sort of capture it in association, in a way, consciously, you know. But it's interesting to me the degree to which the writing of anything to me is secondary to a certain kind of experience. First of all, I see the world, and then it's interesting to me to make a record of the fact. But nothing I do is in order to write.
Apparently not, because, as, you know, you've been told so often, this is, you know, 21 years, you know, that people have been waiting for your second book. Did you feel any rush to bring another one out?
I didn't really. I mean, I'm happy to have written another book. I take a good deal of satisfaction from the fact that Housekeeping is not an only child anymore. But on the other hand,
I live in order to live and write as an expression of experience. I would hate the idea of writing a book I didn't really feel.
Hmm. How did you prepare for this book? Because you make references throughout to, well, here's some of them, Jean-Paul Sartre, bean salads, which look distinctly Presbyterian, Calvin, Karl Barth, the diary of a country priest. Your character reads volumes. Did you as well?
Oh, yes, I read a lot. And I've read a great deal of theology because good theology is very beautiful. It's like epic poetry or something. It's just very beautiful.
You also are teaching writing. What do you tell those who come looking to do the next housekeeping or now the next Gilead, looking to write?
What I do basically is try to tell them that what they should do is write the book or the fiction that they want to read. I think anybody who wants to write feels that there is some vision or sense of things that is not present, not represented in the world. And that's their testimony. That's the thing that they can't, you know, that they should do to help them find and value their individuality is probably the first thing to do.
And what can we know about you in the few minutes we have left? Who are you? Where'd you come from?
One of those great mysteries, isn't it? Well, you know, I grew up in Idaho. I went to college at Brown. I went to graduate school at the University of Washington. I have two children, two sons who are both grown men. I've lived in Iowa for about 15 years. People tend to think of biography as event, but for a lot of people, I think biography is perception and thought, at least very, very largely. I think part of the reason John Ames is the kind of character he is, insofar as he's expressing, you know, me, is that I like the idea that how people think is an enormously large constituent of many people's lives, which tends to be slighted. You know, I mean, when you have a life like his that occurred in a very small compass, was it a large life or a small life? I think that if you only knew biographical facts about him, you'd say very small. But I think if you know where his thoughts have been, you'd say very large.
Marilynne Robinson, thank you so much for Gilead and for talking to us about it.
Pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Marilynne Robinson, the author of Gilead, a novel that chronicles generations of preachers through letters from an elderly father to his young son. Here is a reading of one of those letters.
There was more to it, of course. For me, writing has always felt like praying, even when I wasn't writing prayers, as I was often enough. You feel that you are with someone. I feel I'm with you now, whatever that can mean. Considering that you're only a little fellow now, and when you're a man, you might find these letters of no interest. Or they might never reach you for any of a number of reasons. Well, but how deeply I regret any sadness you have suffered, and how grateful I am in anticipation of any good you have enjoyed. That is to say, I pray for you, and there's an intimacy in it. That's the truth.
A reading from Marilynne Robinson's wonderful new book, Gilead, which just won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Best Fiction of 2004. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.